The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On May 8, 2007, the Korea Society hosted a contemporary issues program on the recently published novel, A Corpse in the Koryo. This is the first English-language murder mystery set entirely in North Korea, which is known officially as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or the DPRK. Written under a pen name by a senior U.S. intelligence official with decades of experience working with the DPRK, A Corpse in the Koryo follows Inspector Oh, a North Korean detective, as he navigates the country's murky byways in the course of investigating a highly unusual death. A panel of experts made up of the Republic of Korea's ambassador to the United Nations, Choi Young-jin, Fletcher School Dean Stephen Bosworth, and international lawyer Lucy Reed, all veteran visitors to the DPRK in their early work with the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization, known as KEDO, discusses the novel and the policy issues that it deftly raises between its lines.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the Korea Society. We have a goodly number of folks who've turned up for this most mysterious evening of discussion. And I must say, speaking of programs, I've been at this podium, or I've been on a panel when we have done political issues and economic issues and trade issues, music, art. But I don't know that I've ever participated in a discussion of a murder mystery at the Korea Society. This is indeed a first. It's a rather unique unique event, and I'm delighted that all of you could be here to share this with us. But having described this as a murder mystery, I think it's a little bit more than that, as those of you who have read the book will understand very, very well. It's a book filled with some fascinating insights into what North Korea, the DPRK, is like, what it's really like, as opposed to the caricature or the cartoon-like depictions of it that one often sees in the media. It's an amazingly written novel, and I know it will capture your attention as much as it has mine, and obviously that of our panelists as well. It was written by an author who uses a pseudonym, but the author is described as a former U.S. official, and let me use this platform to tell you that's not me, although I would have liked to have been the author of this one. But this pseudonymic author obviously has spent a lot of his time working on this particular target, so to speak, and has developed incredible insights into how North Korea works, or doesn't, as the case may be, really gives you a flavor throughout the book of what it must be like to live in a country that I once described as a parallel universe. I'll say no more about that because I know our panelists will want to get into this in a deep way. And speaking of our panelists, we are really honored tonight. We've been delighted over the years to have some incredibly distinguished and knowledgeable people on this platform, a temporary platform, I should add, that will become permanent shortly. We are once again blessed with three good friends and colleagues and three very, very distinguished folks who have joined us here to discuss this book. And I think most of you know them, and there's some biographic material, but for those who do not know them, they really are three wonderful people and good friends, beginning with our chair for the evening, Lucy Reed, who is a partner in Freshfields, Bruckhaus & Berringer. She's a distinguished and noted international lawyer. She is also a member of our board and has been an instrumental player in creating the Korea Society as it is today. And I take my hat off to her for all she's done over the years for us here at the Korea Society. We also have one of my former bosses, Ambassador Steve Bosworth, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, who taught me everything I know about diplomacy, only the good things. and who has had a long and distinguished career as a diplomat himself, ambassador and senior State Department official, and currently dean, as I said, of the Fletcher School, and a good friend of Korea and former ambassador to the Republic of Korea as well. And, of course, last and hardly least, another good friend, Ambassador Choi Young-jin, the permanent representative of the Republic of Korea to the United Nations. Ambassador Choi is a good friend of America, a good friend of mine, a good friend of the Korea Societies. And in addition to his current capacity as ambassador to the United Nations, he's also been vice foreign minister and has served a very long and distinguished career representing Korea in various places around the world. They all have something in common, a connection to the peninsula, a connection that is largely the result of their service on the Korea Peninsula Energy Development Organization, KEDO, the now defunct, occasionally defamed, occasionally maligned, but also much respected organization that played a tremendous role in achieving a freeze on the North Korean nuclear weapons development program. At one time, and has set, I think, a tremendously high standard for international negotiations in terms of what it achieved for so many years on the Korean Peninsula. So we are really delighted and honored to have them on this panel tonight. And without any further ado, let me turn it over to Lucy. And if you would give them all a warm welcome, please.
It's always a great pleasure for me to have a KEDO reunion with Steve and Ambassador Che from our early days in the DPRK before it was a maligned, or too badly maligned, an organization, and certainly before it was defunct. But we're here not to talk about KEDO. We're here for this atypical Korea Society program. We hope to have just some fun talking about this novel, A Corpse in the Koryo, written, as you heard Evan say, under the pseudonym of James Church. But we are here just to have fun. But the book we want to talk about on several levels, and I think the best way to illustrate that is to quote from a statement that James Church wrote to Eric Weingartner of the Canada-Korea Electronic Information Service in this printout from today that everyone has. Right, Fred? These are some materials, some reviews of the book, and there's a discussion between Eric Weingartner and Victor Hsu from World Vision about this book, which I urge you to read after the program. But James Church told Mr. Weingartner that he wrote this book for a specific reason besides entertainment. And I'm quoting him. "The title would lead you to believe that it is a mystery, but actually it is an effort to put the structure of a serious detective story to work in the service of illuminating North Korea for Western readers who have been fed a steady diet of stereotypes about the country and its people." So it is entertainment, but it's also a way to reach a broader audience about some realities in North Korea. What we plan to do tonight is I'll take a few minutes to describe the plot of the book and then pose some questions to Dean Bosworth and Ambassador Che, and then we hope to open it up so everyone can talk. It's not meant to be a formal presentation by any means. How many people, just to help me out here, how many people have read the book yet? Okay. Very well. Very good. Not enough for me not to have to be careful and ruin the plot. I'm not going to ruin it because I want you all to buy it and read it yourselves. It is a detective story, and so the plot is not meant to be simple. And one of the reasons I was happy to do this program is I had to read it again, and I think I understood better. I don't know about you all, what actually did happen. It opens in August of 2002 with the main character, Inspector Oh, who is a slightly irreverent detective attached to the Ministry of People's Security, which is the police, in Pyongyang, tasked to go out at dawn to photograph a car, the only car, that would be coming down a highway outside Pyongyang. And when the car finally comes, of course, his camera doesn't work because the battery doesn't work in the camera issued by the police department. Or perhaps there was never a battery in the camera at all, which starts the mystery running. So our Inspector O finds himself very quickly sucked into a clash between rival North Korean intelligence services, who we find out later in the book are running competing car smuggling schemes, which leads us to meet the elusive, or I really should say the omnipresent, Deputy Director Kang from the Investigations Department and supposedly Captain Kim from the Joint Headquarters of the police. Now, Inspector O is not very happy to find himself in what soon become dangerous circumstances, but as you tell from reading the book, there's not really much he can do about it. His normal instincts as a survivor in North Korea, as an investigator, to be able to separate his friends from his foes and know exactly how far he can go, for example, by not wearing his great leader pin, perhaps in part because his grandfather was a great war hero. He can get away with that, but he can't get away with other things, like riding his bicycle across the traffic circle when there's no traffic because the police girl who's there won't allow it under any circumstances. But he's learned to find his way through his life in North Korea until this all happens. And then he finds that he's on a path where he doesn't know which way to turn and his instincts don't serve him well. And lest you think I'm making this sound too existential, our Inspector O also finds throughout the book that it's impossible ever to find a hot cup of tea or a thermos of hot water wherever he is. Now, the more he tries to extricate himself from this battle, the more entangled he gets with the characters. So in an effort really to save him and extricate him, Inspector O, from this, his superior, who actually is my favorite character in the book, this loyal and very melancholy Mr. Park sends Inspector O on a train journey to Kangay and then all the way up to Mampo at the Chinese border, trying to get out of this warfare. But instead, things just get worse for him, not the least of which by being hit on the back of the head several times, waking up in strange rooms in inns with strange nurses. But he slowly learns that the events that are literally threatening his life have been triggered by a major leadership decision back in Pyongyang linked to the policy towards Japan. And I'm quoting here from the South China Morning Post review of the book, quote, "Quickly enough, O is dealing with murderous cadres, enigmatic prostitutes, and a cadaver," that's the corpse in the choreo, "that may or may not be a European nuclear inspector, who may or may not be tied up with the rival smuggling rings." Now, what's particularly interesting, I think, is this story is told in the first person, and it alternates between flashbacks or memories of Inspector O of all the events and an interrogation that's going on by a British, really an Irish intelligence agent, who's a bit bigger than life, named Richie Molloy, who starts his questions, and by the way, I think by now there have been several other murders to solve. Richie Molloy is interrogating him, starting with all the stereotypes that go with North Korea. These are illustrated in his questions. But throughout the book, as we hear more of the interrogation, in addition to livening the story, we realize that this vehicle, if you will, allows what's a political abstract clash between two such different cultures really is boiling down to an interchange between two human beings. And here, they're two members of the same tribe, intelligence officers, trained intelligence agents from different systems, who end up having emotional lives and well-rounded lives despite their differences. So I won't tell you how it ends. We hear there are going to be a few sequels, but plot aside, one of the questions that the author, I'm sure, tries to get to is through the book to ask how it is that someone like Inspector O or Mr. Pak can endure the political pressures that they are under and the social pressures that they're under, but continue to be loyal friends and loyal co-workers and loyal family in a society that we, as people with many more freedoms, would not recognize. And despite it, as the author has written, retain their humanity. So that's a race through a complex book. The reviews will tell you that in addition to being clever and witty and topical, the book is beautifully written, especially for a first novel. Now, I have to say, I don't know how you feel, Stephen Youngshin, I took offense at the reviews, at the suggestion that an intelligence officer or a government employee wouldn't know how to write well. Because I'm from the State Department, we're all from Ministries of Foreign Affairs, and of course we all write beautifully, but I think we all remember, in fact, my husband's here tonight, and he once said to me that he couldn't believe a lawyer could write good letters. but we can, and I think we all remember that intelligence officers in particular are prized for their ability to put the big picture into a cable, in the old days, a cable, as well as the important details that allow nuance to come through. And even if our James Church was not allowed to do that as much as he wanted to do when he was an intelligence agent for a Western agency, because he had to look through a moral bubble whenever he talked about North Korea, he's now done it in this novel, which brings great fun and thoughtfulness for us. So, with that race, let me ask you two. You've been in the DPRK. You're originally from the DPRK. How realistic do you think the book was in terms of the place, the people, and the politics?
Youngjin,
please.
Well, I have not spent weeks and months in the DPRK. I visited there a couple of times and worked with a good number of North Koreans, and through them you begin to get some insight into what their country is like or their society is like. But I was very impressed by the level of detail in the book and the kind of granularity of the descriptions of places and people and the way things work. And I came away with the feeling that the book describes real people. And when we were working at Cato, we used to, as I recall, occasionally observe in our dealings with North Korea that these were not just empty suits. They were real human beings. And they responded to the same set of stimuli as other people. They had the same concerns about family. They happened to live in a society or a political system that was quite different from ours, although I would observe that I think every political system has the capacity to produce its own level of dysfunctionality, including our own. And we probably see that in evidence on regular occasions. I think the author describes a world that has a sense, you have a sense that it's real. It is, and above all, as Lucy has suggested, it's not a world inhabited by crazy people or demented people. It is a world of ordinary people who are forced to behave in ways that are occasionally bizarre and sometimes unexpected by the system within which they exist. So I come away from the book wondering why it is that in our official dealings with North Korea, by and large, we have a great deal of difficulty in adjusting to the fact that North Korea is a place, and it's inhabited by members of our species. They behave very differently in some respects than we do. But on the other hand, they will respond in a very similar fashion as we do to some of the stimuli that they receive. I must confess that I know this genre quite well. Anyone who travels a couple of 100,000 miles a year on airplanes, if they're honest, at least I hope, they will admit that they don't spend all of their time writing serious stuff and reading philosophy. And yet you have to somehow get through that long night over the Pacific or wherever it is you're going. And so I read a lot of this stuff. And this is really one of the best that I've read in some time. I would compare this stuff to P.D. James and Henning Mankell. I mean, it's got that kind of granularity and texture and richness of narrative in it. It's a serious piece of writing. And as a longtime devotee of the genre, I can, without reservation, recommend this to anybody who's looking for something to do for several hours while they're flying in an airplane. Or if you're just sitting around your living room and want something to do, it's worth a read. So.
Thanks.
When I read this book, A Corpse in the Choreo, two other books came to my mind. This Corpse in the Choreo describes the situation of North Korea, and I read two other books, one describing the life on the Soviet Union. The Goalkeeper by Martin Smith. And the other one is about everyday life in East Germany, the famous The Spy Who Came In From the Cold by John Le Carré. I happened to visit Moscow and Berlin, East Germany, in 1990 for the first time, and North Korea 1996, and I could see the similarities of all three places. That's why when I read this book, the other two books came to my mind, and I, in my mind, automatically compared the ordinary life, the facade of these three countries, North Korea, East Germany, and Soviet Union. And understandably, the descriptions are very similar because we are describing a society tightly controlled, regimented, suffocating, and sometimes very scary. You see in this book, even the Inspector O, who is a very high official, still has to worry about the rationing of his food and gas when he travel, and he does never get the tea he wanted so much, and he does not have freedom to move inside his own country. And you know how much disciplined the country, the people are, because one of the most intriguing facts is the encounter, to my mind, between Inspector Oi and his brother, who is, I surmise, is a party official, party nomenclature, who is very much worried about his own life because of his brother's not wearing the badge, which is a safety badge in the society. And this is how the people are regimented in this society. And when you read, following the trail of Inspector O in the different cities of North Korea, Gangye, Manpo, Sinuiju, Hyangsan, the atmosphere described by the author is really suffocating, and that's what he felt when you were in North Korea. You don't have any freedom to move out of the hotel, and you cannot really travel as you want, even at the vicinity of the place where you stay. And this is the atmosphere well described, without really violating the framework set out by a detective novel, the same way the Goalkeeper, what is Spy Came In From the Cold, because if you introduce a fantasy, then it is no more a detective story. But it is the descriptions are faithful to the fact, but still it maintains the level of suspense and intrigue to arouse your curiosity, maintain your curiosity from first page to the last. So I think on this score, this is a very interesting book. I didn't expect, when I opened the first page, I didn't expect to read until the last page. But thanks, credit to the author. This is really fully packed with suspense and intrigue that will carry you on from the first to the last page. The other layer I would like to mention is quoting Churchill's famous words about Russia. He said, Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. So the ordinary life is enigma, as I try to explain, tightly controlled, regimented, suffocating, and scary. Then you have the middle part, middle layer, which is mystery. And that life described by the lives of protagonists in the book, such as Inspector O, his immediate boss, Park. Then you have this dreadful Colonel Kim, representing military security. Then you have enigmatic deputy director Kang, who represent investigations department, and the brother of Inspector O, who is from the party. And they are privileged and loyal to the system because they are privileged. They have interest in keeping the regime alive. And that description fits in the image we drew when he dealt with KEDO officials from North Korea. And they were very loyal, very able, but still they were privileged class of the regime, and they were product of the regime, they were prisoner of the regime in the end. And this is what we learned from the protagonist. They were representative of the regime, of the ordinary life I described just a while ago. And in this sense, Inspector is not different from Arkady Renko of the goalkeeper or Comrade Fiddler of the spy who came in from the cold. They are faithful, loyal, but still, you know, a victim, prisoner of the regime. Then you have the arrived at the core, the riddle, wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. The riddle is the regime itself, the core of the regime, in other words, the leadership. And this remains really as a riddle in this book, the same way in the book of the goalkeeper, the spy who came in from the cold. The core of the regime never reveals itself, but there are enough clues with which you can imagine, you can figure out what is the nature of the regime. In this case, the regime reveals its face in the interplay between what it did decades ago by abducting Japanese and now the desire to normalize relationship with Japan, which will engender billions of dollars. Actually, that was the case in 2001, when then Prime Minister Goijin went to Pyongyang. There was a lot of rumors, speculations, how much Pyongyang would get through normalization with Japan. And they talked about $10 billion even. So how to harmonize in the regime's mind, the core of the leadership's mind, how to harmonize this need to get a lot of cash, and how to undo what it did decades ago by abducting Japanese from Japanese soil. And this reveals the nature of the regime to my mind, the attempt to erase part of its own past by even murdering people of its own organization. And that's the thing we find in the book of the spy who came in from the cold. The difference between the two regimes. This, for those who did not read the spy who came in from the cold, is British spy organizations fighting against East German spy organization, and that is the main plot. And both organizations use people, their own people, to achieve the objective. Difference is British intelligence organization tried to rescue their own people in the end. At the Berlin War, the Smiley was waiting for Alec Lima's comeback, come through over the hill, over the wall, and his Smiley is crying out, and I am Alec, Alec. Jump, jump. So that is how British intelligence tried to save its own people. On the other hand, East German intelligence society is not bothering killing its own people. So then maybe the difference how we can imagine the difference of the regime between British intelligence and East German intelligence. And by extension of it, we can try to get some clue about the nature of the regime, which is not revealed in this book, but this book gives us enough clue to have some sense of the nature of the regime. So that is what I can tell you, quoting Churchill, "A riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma." And this book, "A Corpse in the Choreo," fits in this description of Churchill by presenting three layers of mystery in this uninhibited, uninviting country, because travel is not allowed in this country by foreigners, but also by his own people inside the own country. And I think it's a great book to read, not only to pass the time, but to understand the nature of such a country like North Korea, Soviet Union, or East Germany.
Just to follow up on something Ambassador Chase said, that certainly a test of good fiction is that the author doesn't tell you what's happening, but shows you what's happening. And I hadn't really thought until you said that how... And nowhere does the author say, oh, everywhere he went, Inspector O was followed. Instead, every time he steps out of a door, finds out he's followed. Every grandma outside of the Kangi train station, for example, the grandma he happens to stop and buy some snacks from and ask where to stay, who seems a neutral character, ends up being deeply embedded with Mr. Kang, in ways that aren't explained and to us seem impossible, but clearly are happening. And every time he gets hit on the head, he always says, I know they've trained me not to turn around and look, but I can't help it. And then boom, and then he says, and I knew as I fell towards the ground that my left knee was buckling before my right, so I would wrench my back. Yet again in the service. So it's somewhat lightweight. But a more serious question is, and one that I really have thought about a lot as I prepared for this panel, is how do you explain, or how does one explain, that the higher level officials in the book, some of them are quite corrupt. They're smuggling, they're getting money, they have all the luxuries, they're trying to kill these lower level people. And Inspector O, who lives a very frugal life in a lonely room, a bachelor, with almost no pleasures, a little bit of Finnish vodka once in a while, does his job and remains, it seems, absolutely loyal to this regime, despite what he sees with his superiors and despite what he knows of life in the outside. Do you have any thoughts on that, Steve?
Nothing very profound, I don't think. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, systems of this sort do produce corruption, because that's the way that people sort of exist, or some people choose to exist. But I think also systems of this sort also have some people who are still true believers. And whether Inspector O is a true believer or not is not clear to me, but he clearly is a man of some honor and principle. And he does not succumb to the temptation to violate his principles, even though all around him people are, not Mr. Park necessarily, but others. I was reminded when I read the book of something that was, when I was trying to learn something about Korea back in the early 90s, someone said to me, I think it was probably someone from our own intelligence business, saying that any time four North Koreans get together, each of them thinks that at least two of the others work for some sort of security service. And certainly that comes through in this book, because everyone you see is the object of suspicion of someone else. Even the girl who runs the elevator that goes up to the top of the Chuche Tower to take Mr. Kang and Inspector O up there so they can have a truly confidential conversation, even she is suspect.
And probably rightly so.
Yeah. Or she wouldn't have the key to the Chuche Tower elevator.
Ambassador Che, any comments on that?
Corruption described in this book is certainly flagrant, but if you think about the whole system of communism, this corruption is in a way self-limited. The Soviet production system is very peculiar in a way that this is the most genius system, because Stalin could get everything the nation produces. Everything is his. So he introduced sort of corruption by allowing people to take care of their own lives after the official hour work. That's how the system lived. In other words, during the official work, every production made by the people are in the possession of Stalin himself and his party. Then how do people live? After the official work hours, Stalin allowed them to find a way to make their own living and without tax. This is the corruption. Every individual has a small patch outside his own garden where they can produce vegetables, fruits, and without tax. They sold them, part of they ate them. And in the end, those small patches amounted to 2% of total territory, but produced 50% of agricultural production. Even in the factory, there is a corruption, but limited in the factory network, not widespread outside of the network. This is how the system worked. So even the same with this book, there is a widespread corruption, but in a way self-contained. And that's how the system lived. They allowed the corruption to make their own living, and which was produced officially went into the hands of the state. And by that fashion, the regime could ensure the loyalty of the nomenclature of the country.
Now, Peter Hayes from the Nautilus Institute wrote about this novel that it is, and I quote, "the best unclassified account of how North Korea works and why it has survived all these years when the rest of the communist world capitulated to the global market a decade ago." End quote. "This novel should be required bedtime reading for President Bush and his national security team." Now, I'm not sure I would go that far, and I don't think it's going to happen either, but Steve, having said that, what are there any lessons you think that could be drawn if you could slip this into the airplane bag of some neocons?
I think the number one lesson, for me at least, is that we should be negotiating with North Korea as North Korea is, not as we have conjured it up to be in our own rhetorical exchanges in which we sort of vie with one another, not we here, but Americans vie with one another to paint North Korea as the craziest, most demented, most evil place on the face of the earth. And we tend to pitch our negotiating tactics and tenor toward that North Korea. And we wonder why we get strange results and why they sort of walk away from us. I think, you know, we should try to deal with North Korea as it is, and treat it as a collection of human beings, even though it's a system that for us is incomprehensible in some ways. But we tend to negotiate. Instead of negotiating with North Korea, we negotiate with each other's ideological stances on North Korea. And I think we would be much better off trying to deal with them and not deal with our own Republicans and Democrats, and we're soft and they're not, or we're firm and they're not, because we end up in bizarre situations that way, like sending a negotiating team to North Korea to confront them over what we thought was their enriched uranium program without any idea of what they would say in response or what we would do then, simply because we were driven by our own ideological conviction that somehow these guys always lie, they always cheat, and so we've caught them, and now let's go up there and tell them, gotcha. But that doesn't take us anyplace.
Ambassador Che.
I think there is an important lesson to, if we are smart enough, so we can draw from this book, that is the dilemma the leadership is facing of North Korea. It's not an ordinary dilemma, but I would qualify it as a strategic dilemma between two unpalatable choices. Here in this book, the leadership, the core of the riddle is undecisive in a way which options to take, whether completely wipe out the past and come clean. I'm one of you, so let's live together. Or keep the legacy somehow alive and to ensure the loyalty by which preserve the nature of the regime in a way. That's what we are confronted with in North Korean nuclear question, to my mind. If you read this book, you will realize that everything is linked to everything. There is no standalone issue. The same with the North Korean nuclear question. This is not a standalone issue. North Korean nuclear question is a part of a bigger North Korean problem itself. That's what we have to admit at first place. Then we can proceed from them. Without resolving North Korean problem, we cannot be able to resolve North Korean nuclear question. Then we can proceed to the second step, which is how to deal with the North Korean dilemma, strategic dilemma between political survival and economic revival. We are dealing with this dilemma unless we do not intend to improbable regime change or regime collapse, which to my mind not inducible. North Korea is a stable country, even though tightly controlled, and we cannot induce regime collapse because the regime will be, the people rally around the regime if they perceive outside the threat. So regime collapse is not inducible, and we cannot provoke regime change there. If it happens, it must happen in a natural way by itself. So we all we have to do is, admitting the North Korean dilemma, we cannot help North Korea resolve this dilemma unless they do it by themselves, then we have to think about management as opposed to resolution of North Korean problem until there is a leadership change inside North Korea. So this is a lesson we can learn from this book, which is excellently described the nature of the regime in the end, the agony of the regime, dilemma of the regime. From that, we can proceed this sort of deduction arriving at management of North Korean question, nuclear question, as opposed to resolution of North Korean question.
No, and I think a more human level, one of the things the book does show is, it's a stereotype, but this one I think is true, and that is the fear with which North Koreans, particularly government people, live on a daily basis. It's something that struck all of us and many of you, I know, since you've, when you've been there, the constant fear of being, you know, ratted upon or legitimately or not legitimately and being followed and saying too much. And I have a very vivid memory of when I was leading negotiations for Kido in North Korea. And, of course, I had to adjust my negotiating style quite a bit to deal with the fear aspect. But I remember Ambassador Che saying to our teams, only those who are feel safe, who don't feel fear, can afford to be kind in a negotiation, and having that affect how we had daily dealings. And I'll never forget the look of just terrible fear on the face of the chambermaid at one of the hotels we stayed at when I had left an old towel that I brought with me on purpose because I knew there weren't towels, and I just left it because I didn't want to carry a wet towel back, and she came running after me with this towel, said, please take this, and being advised I should take it for fear that she would be punished for being found with this. And that sounds stereotypical, but those were things we ran into all the time when we were there. So we can't just assume that's just the same as our lives by any means. But having laid out some of these ideas, I did have one more point from the book. I didn't understand the focus in the book on Inspector O's habit of sanding little pieces of wood. He kept in his pocket little pieces of wood that he would not sand into any sculpture or anything, but just work on. And he had different personalities for different woods, apparently from his grandfather. And in one of the reviews I read, I should have thought of it, pointed out that this is really probably a coping mechanism, one of the ways to deal with pressure and the fears of everyday life, just something to do, like we all have nervous habits in it. But it was a nice literary device as well. Having said all these things, how about comments, questions, observations from the group. Yes?
I just like to invite speculation on why so much of the novel seems to take place in relatively remote parts of Korea, of North Korea, like Kangae and up in the northeast where hardly anybody is.
Taker?
I think it takes place in many parts of the North Korea, Gangye, Manpo, Pyongyang, the murder happens in Hotel Goryeo where we stayed one time or another. And also in Hyangsan, where the Finnish lady was killed. So it happens all different places, but
I told
probably,
you not to give away the plot.
Probably you are right. One has the impression that we are dealing with the same place, and which is true. When you go, everywhere you go, you have these cities do not have a characteristic, all the same. So you have the impression that you are dealing with even one city, but there are different cities, but the description are the same because they are the same.
Steve?
No, I think to take us to those different places, each is a little different, but there's also a sameness about all of North Korea. The atmosphere is the same, whether you're in the Koryo Hotel or whether you're up in the mountains someplace. And the same fear, the same tension exists on the part of the people who are living there.
Plus, it also, I think, showed that the author has been to many places.
Yes,
or talk to people who've been to many places in North Korea. Fred.
You mentioned the chambermaid, the wet towel, and it reminded me of thoughts that I've had sometime, and that is, have I ever met somebody who wasn't part of the elite or the ruling class or something when I've been in North Korea? And I've found it hard to completely answer that question with a sense of confidence. I mean, but in the book, do you get some sense of life outside of that highly... I haven't had the opportunity to read the book yet. Does it give you also some sense of life outside of that circle? And therefore, to some extent, could it really qualify as a kind of ethnography, I mean, rather than just, you know, an account of what the creme de la creme or these special categories of people are like?
I think you do, yes. I think you get a sense of some of Inspector Ho's neighbors in his apartment building who are trying to play matchmaker initially and then back away very quickly when he points out that if he got married to one of their candidates, he would have to move someplace else and they would no longer have an inspector living in their building, and they don't like that thought. So, but yeah, I think you get a sense of other people outside the elites, but the interaction, the characters, the main characters are all part of the elite, as Youngjin has pointed out.
We at Kedo, we have the luxury to have them to the same person, some elites, for more than 2 years. Over negotiation, over dinner, over drink. So we come across, came up with a certain impression on what kind of people they are. And the conclusion is twofold. One is they are like us. They have the same emotion. They have the same human nature. They have the same yearning for family security, their own security. And they can open their heart, given occasion, and even personable, but in the end, they remain prisoner of the regime. They could not really get out of this cocoon.
Fred, I would say I think in the book there are the pure elites, and then there are more functionaries like Inspector O and some lower people, but I don't know the answer. One of the things I scratched my head over in reading the book is whether, say, the grandma outside the Kangi train station was really some intelligence agent who was dressed up to do this, or was a local who was told to do it for these limited purposes for fear of her life if she didn't do it Well, there's one scene, I can't remember it, where another person who comes up behind Inspector O is wearing a much too nice a shirt underneath his peasant uniform. So that's an enigma.
One of the reasons that that question interests me is that an argument that is made sometimes for the stability of the Chosun government, because you know it lasted twice as long as the Ming and the Qing, I mean, the combined Ming and Qing. One of the reasons given is that the Confucian values of the elite so permeated down to to everyone that there was a kind of a general, I use the term, yangbanization of the society, and so they all bought into the system. So there's a history in Korea of, you know, the Hyangban as opposed to the Yangban and so forth, the local Yangban, the Hyangban, buying into a system of ideology, and that really became the rock of stability. That would support your argument that, you know, that Mr. Che, that it's not something we can overthrow easily. It's going to fall apart from internal reasons. But it also is, you know, it may make this question of who really is elite very, very interesting. But of course, you know, this is, as you say, it's stratified. And
there's a question in the back, I know.
Mr. Bosworth, what you had said about the idea that we all have our societies, all the nationalities of the world, the people who live in those nationalities have certain I forget the precise word, but the idea that there's certain reluctancies to exhibit feelings about things and so forth and so on. And it just occurred to me the other day that. For instance, people won't discuss the cost of things with their next-door neighbors in America because they don't want to look foolish for having paid too much. Maybe I'm saying more about myself than anybody else, but it occurred to me this is probably a universal that they won't discuss salaries about one another and so forth and so on. So this being the case in this free world in which America sees itself as being. If you have, you're saying, though, four Koreans together in North Korea, and two suspect the other two of somehow ratting on them or ratting out on them, possibly or potentially. So there's a sense of fear and paranoia in the society of North Korea that allows for the regime to have an easy go of it, maintaining its power, just because of that. And I was wondering if in the book this is somehow, not having read it, this is somehow conveyed this sort of atmosphere of slipping up, or you know, is it created so that you really get a palpable sense of this? What I'm suggesting, which I don't know if it's the case, but I would think that if it's a really good novel, it would probably conjure up this kind of feeling in the reader. So I wonder if you felt that there were certain feelings that the citizens of North Korea have that are especially pungent psychologically in the novel. So, anyone?
Well, I would only say that I think in every system, every culture, there is a price to be paid for deviationism, if you will. That price is a lot higher in North Korea than it is in other societies, including our own. But we all have that tendency to punish deviationism. You look at any administration in Washington, D.C., and you can see that immediately. It's all very well and good for us to say, well, so-and-so should have said this and should have left or should have resigned publicly. But at that point in time, so-and-so is not willing to pay that political price. In the case of North Korea, the price is more than just being ostracized. Potentially, the price is very high indeed. I mean, I remember the first time we took the North Korean delegation to a restaurant in New York for lunch and confronted by what was to them obviously a confusing menu, the predictable happened. When the head of the delegation decided what he wanted for lunch, everybody else had the same thing all the way down the line. Because not having what the head of delegation had ordered posed a risk, and they weren't willing to take that risk.
Was it filet mignon?
No. It was something much more bizarre or much more prosaic than filet mignon.
Yes.
Do you think that a good movie could be made out of this book?
Oh, what a good question.
Sounds very exciting without painting North Korea in a very bad light.
Because my answer would be, I think a very good movie could be made of this book, but probably very few people would go and see it.
I would suspect that a better movie could be made by South Korean filmmakers than by American filmmakers. Because they would be better able to convey the nuances. We would have a tendency to, I think most of our filmmakers would portray the North Koreans as crazy and demented.
What do you think, Ambassador Che? Movie?
Why not? Why not? But
I want to be the
first. I would like to.
Even though we now
when it comes to movie. When it comes to movie, I'd like to quote a words which struck the chord with the Korean people by your most successful director of a film. He says, he exploits rising nationalism of Korean people. That is the theme of his movie. He made several movies, very successful, but the cutting across the theme is Korean nationalism. So if you can somehow fuse Korean nationalism with this book, then you can have a very successful film.
If I may, I think policy has done that.
Just to carry the line, could this book be published in North Korea as simply a story?
Who would read it?
No.
Who would read it? No.
It could be published, but I don't think anyone would read it. Because, again, the pain, the penalty potentially for engaging in such spiritual deviationism would be very high.
But isn't the premise, if it's approved, therefore one can read?
I don't see it ever being approved.
It's very critical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although the idea of a revolutionary opera of this is intriguing. Yes.
The movie idea is really good, and maybe it's because there's such a inherently strong drama when you have this kind of authoritarian backdrop and a professional protagonist who really wants to do a great job and really wants to be competent and fulfill his duty. Reminds me of Bridge on the River Kwai, where they wanted to build the bridge, but of course they're building it for the Japanese, their captors, and they have to blow it up at the end. Or, more recently, The Lives of Others, which is this fabulous film about East Germany, the secret police, where the hero of the movie, the central character, is a Stasi officer who is the most consummate professional secret agent you could ever imagine. And he's hunting down dissent and trying to stifle it, and you really like the guy, even though that's his profession. And at the end of the movie, of course, there's a transition where he recognizes that this is horrendous and unfair to his victims, and ends up rescuing his primary victim from a potentially horrendous fate, one of his victims. Any case, I think the backdrop of this book, the authoritarian backdrop, really it makes for a strong drama, and could make a great film.
Right there. Oh, this young gentleman in the middle.
I wanted to ask if, do you think Americans in particular are like particularly incapable of understanding North Koreans as a people or as a regime because we live in such an open information society? And like I think we are similarly indoctrinated that information can exist outside of people or outside of ideologies, whereas in North Korea, all information is ideological, and nothing can exist, or in my understanding that no information exists outside of its position as political or non-political.
When the Berlin Wall fell, I was happened to be in the States, and many, even most, people I encountered predicted the fall of regime of China and North Korea. It didn't happen. The mistakes made by many experts in this country was that they had only one dimension of the example type. Communist country should fall. So Soviet Union fell, East Germany fell, then other communist countries like China and North Korea should fall. It didn't happen because there are varieties, differences. And North Korea is difficult to understand because it represents a third type of communist country. You have Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries, communist countries, which fell, disappeared. Then you have China and Vietnam survive, even prosperous, because they opened up the society for investment and trade. North Korea is in between the East German type and China-Vietnam type. They are not Eastern European type of communist country, but they cannot follow the example of China and Vietnam. They are in dilemma. So you have to take into account this complexity of different type of different situation to understand North Korea. But if we have only one-dimensional thinking, communism should fall, thus North Korea should fall, then it will not happen.
Steve, any comments on that?
No, not really. I think Youngjin has said it well. I think we probably have somewhat of an exaggerated view of the accessibility to information in our own system. And periodically we confront a situation that brings us up against that, the reality of our exaggeration. But clearly in North Korea, although the book does describe some day-to-day interchanges among some of the characters, which I think would confirm that not everything that is said there has an ideological thrust. But by and large, I think your point is well taken.
Yes, sir.
This may be somewhat off point, but can any parallel be drawn between North Korea and Cuba? North Korea has, by default, the national leader. Cuba still has the loved national leader. Can any parallels be drawn?
I think only a very few. I think I find their two situations quite different. You know, the enmity of the United States has played a major role in keeping Castro in power because it helps him to rally his own support. Now, one could argue that the same is true in North Korea in that every authoritarian regime or totalitarian regime needs an external enemy, and we play that role for North Korea. And clearly there is a degree of indoctrination as to our position and our role, and the feeling being that, you know, if they let down their guard for even a moment, we'll whack them the way we've whacked other people. So I think and there is that parallel. But I mean, this is a Confucian culture at bottom compared to a very Latin culture in Cuba. And I think the cultural differences are extreme.
In the back.
Just regarding the author of this book, the mystery behind this, there was a fellow out who wrote a book, and his name is John 12 Hawks, and I guess he was on the New York Times bestseller list, but nobody knows who he is. And his editor doesn't even know who he is. And it's fascinating because when he calls his editor, he uses one of these, Globalstar kind of these things. It's not a traditional cell phone. He uses an international, sort of an absolutely untraceable way of contacting his editor. And so, and he insists that he does this because of the increasing big brotherism of the world. With London, if you live in London, your photograph is recorded, your image is recorded 370 times in a month period or whatever it is, a 24-hour period. So the idea is with this fellow is what he's discussing, the nature of what he's discussing in his book, which is just about this very thing, about more and more of a loss of individual freedoms or individual privacy in the West as well as anywhere in the world. So I just find it, is it, well, you people may have interfaced with the author. So I'm asking you by way of, of secondhand information, is it, there's any motivation outside of, the content of the book that brought the author to, or authoress to, remain incognito. So.
What's your theory?
I have two theories, neither of which is which are not necessarily mutually contradictory. One is that the publication of a book using a pen name. Remember the book Anonymous, that was
Primary
written
Colors.
Primary Colors.
By Joe Klein.
And I'm convinced that added a substantial volume to the sale of that book because nobody knew for a long time who it was. And, in fact, we met Joe Klein at your home. After he was no longer anonymous, I might add.
He got in a lot of trouble.
The other explanation, the one I could think of, is that this is a person who is not necessarily resigned to no longer being a participant in some of the policy discussions about North Korea, and even indeed to traveling to North Korea. And as long as he has this, he or she has this veil of anonymity, there's the possibility of plausible deniability.
Theory?
I agree with Steve that the author was very smart to write this book on the pseudonym pen name. Very smart for many reasons. And when it comes to identity of the author, I am absolutely certain that this person traveled North Korea many times. And there are not many people who traveled North Korea many times. One thing I have some suspicions, but I'm not sure of, is this person may have been involved in a nuclear deal with North Korea, business negotiation with North Korea.
Yes, please.
I'd like to just express what I felt while I was reading this book. I heard that this author, James Church, was North Korean using pseudonym. So what... Now, when you say this U.S. official, it makes all sense to me, because while I was reading, I kept very skeptical. You know, how could it be? This doesn't sound like a North Korean. He didn't act like Korean. He did not interact with the supervisor or bigger brother. To me, North Korean under the Yangban system and this kind of a strict society, it could not possibly to express so freely, liberal, so bold. So I was very skeptical. And some of the also point I was glad he point out, although I know this is a mystery novel, that he, to me, is very confined, this kind of elite society, and never really touched on Korean people's family or individual history. That's my feeling. And also, I don't know much. I never studied literature or anything. I was working in medical field most of my life. As a mystery book, that another point that I was suspecting this cannot be Korean author, as an author, that the description of the scenery and the flow of it, it was too romantic. That's my bet. Thank you for listening.
Well, we're told it's a Western intelligence agent. So,
many of us who have worked in the U.S. government are used to operating behind thin veils of pseudonymity. Very few American ambassadors, for example, will be quoted, like to be quoted on the record by name. It happens occasionally, but usually it's something that is interesting enough to be printed in a newspaper is usually attributed to, or true, is usually attributed to a Western diplomat. And that Western adjective is used, doesn't really fool anybody, but anyway.
Plus we write a lot of non-papers.
Yeah.
Any other comments? I just wanted to, before we close, with one last question, while we're speaking about whether what's typical of a Korean writer or a Westerner or not, I have a favorite little point in the book which will whet the appetite for those of you who haven't read it, where the exotic Finnish Chinese woman, that my part in the movie, says, as she's nursing him back to health after being hit on the head, she says, "Now you're mad at me. Why do Koreans get angry so quickly?" And he says, "We don't. We just don't hide our feelings. I close my eyes. You may not always know what a Korean thinks, but you damn well know what he feels. If anything, we're melancholy more than angry. Listen to our songs, always longing for something." She says, "The Russians are like that, melancholy." And he says, "Any country that produced Stalin has reason to be melancholy." And then it switches over to, as we told you, Richie Malloy, the Irish intelligence agent, is interrogating him after the fact. And I'll quote a bit. "Why do Koreans get mad so quickly?" Richie laughed. "A good question." "Inspector O, not coming from an Irishman, it's not," I said softly. And then after that humor, the author goes on to what I think is really the most poignant, for me, the most poignant scene in the book, where O, Inspector O, tells a story about observing when he was walking down the road in the countryside, an old woman and a small girl. And he tells Richie, "The girl stood with her head bowed, sobbing. Finally, she turned and walked into an empty field as if she wanted to disappear into the earth itself. Why, Richie?" "Why what?" "Why would anyone want to make a child so unhappy? Why would anyone who had already lived their life want to grind a child into the dirt? What possible reason do you think?" "Irishman, that happens. Not like this. This wasn't a scolding. This wasn't a lesson. This was a destruction, an A-bomb. That child had nowhere to go, no sun left to shine, no birds to sing. She'd collapse. That girl had nothing left to hold her together, no tomorrow, no hope. She wasn't really crying. Tears are for the living. She walked into that field like she was already dead. How can that happen in a country?" And I thought about it afterwards as the answer to the question of what motivates this Inspector O to preserve his humanity despite everything he does and sees and happens to him is that even as a North Korean, subject to all these things, he still can criticize total destruction of a human soul and illustrate it this way. So that's to give you a taste of the book. And now my last question to finish is, what do you want to see in the sequel? What are some plot ideas, Ambassador Che, besides nuclear arms talk?
I don't know. I read somewhere that the sequel is expected this fall, so I'll certainly buy one copy and read it with a lot of expectations.
I would just hope to see in the sequel, as in this book, what I called the beginning of our conversation, the granularity in the description of events, life, and scenery in North Korea. I mean, it's not painted with a broad brush. And this is a work that has tiny little brush strokes, and each one of them is fascinating.
Well, I want to see some serious revenge for some of the things that happened to his friends, but I'm not going to tell you what they are. With that, I want to thank you all. You've been a wonderful audience. This has been a lot of fun. We look forward to our sequel, maybe this time next year, to talk about book two.
I want to thank Lucy. Lucy, it was Lucy's idea to do this, and I thought it was a good idea at the time. And in retrospect, I think it was a great idea. It was a lot of fun, at least for us.
And, of course, thanks to the Korea Society.
Thank you very much. Evans asked me to just close down the meeting because he had to rush somewhere. But two quick observations on one of the points you made. Let me just say this. I have friends in Korea that I've known since 1979 at least, so 35 years, that I used to work with for 15, 20 years, who still cannot call me Fred to my face. They call me, Tanjangnim or whatever. They cannot call me Fred. But I have almost every North Korean acquaintance of mine that I've come to know over the last couple of years readily calls me Fred. Not with my prompting, just on their own initiative. I think there are differences, perhaps due to the system they've grown up with, but maybe also partly due to the North versus the South and the degree in which the Yangban notions of this sort of thing have penetrated the society. The second point that I was going to make is that I think that the way that we think about North Korea is partially formed by this all of this stuff that comes in our press, and the point that the young gentleman made here about our sense that we have objective information. Yes, it's out there if we go in search of it, but the groupthink that's reflected through our media on important issues like the DBA issue, for example, the story that's told over and over again, that frankly has a lot of deficiencies in it. It just becomes so much a part of our nature that we believe that we're operating in the system of full information and objectively, and we simply aren't. And the North Koreans actually are aware of that, at least those that have more access to information, and it's a quite an ironic situation, frankly. And we have discussions about that quite regularly. Lastly, anonymity. Brad Martin wrote a book called Under the Loving Care. It has a terribly long title, but it's a very thick book in which he says many things about Kim Jong-il and has deep, detailed reports from refugees and others who have, spoke frankly, I think, in most cases, about what goes on in North Korea. Brad is an old friend of mine, and he really wanted to visit North Korea after he published the book. And, in fact, he did get a visa later, and he went. So, it took a little bit of urging, and it definitely took a little bit of distance and time. I don't know if it would work in every case. But there's a certain kind of pragmatism about the things like this, too. I think I've seen signs of it beyond just this one instance with Brad Martin. They're realists. They understand that, that things are going to be said about them, and they don't necessarily hold a grudge forever. That's what I've noticed. So thank you so much. It was a really fascinating program.
The opinions expressed at this forum do not necessarily reflect those of the Korea Society. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.
The proceeding was a production of the Korea Society. For more information on our programs, please visit www.koreasociety.org.